to use cluster bombs, which our intelligence says they've used as a war crime, to use vacuum bombs, which British intelligence says they've used as a war crime, to indiscriminately attack or intentionally attack civilians in great numbers is a war crime. So three strikes and you're out. I mean, he's committing war crimes as he conducts this war.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine John Herbst on Fox News yesterday. 5 days ago, Russian troops shelled a maternity hospital in the city of Mariupol. An image of a pregnant woman being carried on a stretcher through smoldering rubble shocked the world. Well, today the AP reported that that woman and her baby died. The attack on that maternity ward is just one example of a war crime committed by Russia during its invasion of Ukraine. On Friday in Romania, Vice President Kamala Harris said this about that attack.
We are clear that any intentional attack or targeting of civilians is a war crime. Period.
The International Criminal Court in The Hague is investigating possible war crimes committed by Russia during this war. And joining us to talk about this is Laura Dickinson, law professor at the George Washington University School of Law. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Broadly, what constitutes a war crime?
So war crimes are egregious violations of the law of armed conflict. So deliberately targeting civilians in war, that's a war crime. Using a using weapons in a way that's indiscriminate, in a way that can't distinguish between civilians and military targets, that's a war crime. So also would be torturing prisoners of war or other detainees.
So from what you have seen over these past few weeks, has Russia committed war crimes?
Well, I think there's very strong evidence of that. Unfortunately, we've seen these horrific images, and from the unrelenting shelling of civilians at hospitals and schools, the reported use of cluster munitions, which explode into little bomblets and are indiscriminate when used in heavily populated areas. All of this is very shocking, egregious. It's taken a horrifying toll and looks like war crimes. And I think it's not surprising that the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, has said that these actions against the Ukrainian people by the Russians are war crimes.
Right. And so we are seeing apartment buildings being bombed. We saw, of course, that hospital being bombed. We've seen nuclear facilities also being bombed. Is that incontrovertible evidence, or does that need to be investigated?
Well, there needs to be an investigation. And of course, prosecuting war crimes requires documentation and demonstration of intent. So that can take a while to build that case, but we're certainly seeing the signs that war crimes are being committed.
Right, because Russia, I suppose, is claiming that Ukraine may have set off the bombs that resulted in civilian casualties, or that it wasn't intentional. It has to be intentional.
Well, it has to be intentional, but the indiscriminate use of force in areas where you can't distinguish between civilian and military targets, that's a war crime as well. And sometimes severely reckless behavior can be a war crime as well. But certainly, all of that has to be investigated. And as was noted earlier, the International Criminal Court has opened an investigation into the situation in Ukraine. And they are investigating both war crimes and crimes against humanity, which are systematic and widespread atrocities.
And they're just investigating Russia, or are they investigating?
So they're investigating everyone. So the way that the International Criminal Court works, that's a court, an international court that was created in 2002 by treaty. That court has jurisdiction over war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, and aggression. And they, if they open an investigation, because there's evidence of those crimes being committed, it's in the territory of the place. So they have opened an investigation into Ukraine, and they would investigate all parties, evidence of all parties, if there is evidence of other parties committing war crimes or crimes against humanity.
It should be noted that neither Russia nor the United States, nor for that matter, Ukraine, are members of the ICC. Does that make a difference?
Well, yes, although, so first of all, Ukraine has accepted the jurisdiction of the court. So it is not a party to the court, but because it has accepted the jurisdiction of the court can conduct an investigation, including to acts by Russian nationals, even though Russia is not a party to the court. Now, the only thing is, the court cannot investigate the crime of aggression. I think there's really serious grounds here to think that Russia has committed the crime of aggression. Invading a country without reason is evidence of aggression, but the court is more limited in its ability to investigate aggression. So it can investigate aggression here. Now, the United States is not a party, neither is Russia. But the United States has said that it supports the ICC investigation here. And I think this shows how investigations of atrocities can be in the United States' interest.
How so?
Well, if Russia has committed atrocities, that can help galvanize the international community in condemning Russia, in continuing to impose sanctions for the acts that Russia has taken.
But an investigation and a prosecution, that takes years, right?
Yes, and that's right. And because, you know, establishing criminal responsibility for these kinds of crimes requires a lot of evidence, as it should. However, the process of investigating these crimes is itself very significant and important. And the investigation process can document atrocities in a way that is authoritative and more irrefutable than, for example, media accounts.
So it would be powerful in terms of the pressure it might put on Vladimir Putin, for example, to perhaps halt what he's doing because he's under such international and official condemnation?
Well, I mean, I think at a minimum, it creates a record of what is happening that, again, is more authoritative than just media accounts, right? Second, it can galvanize the world and shore up the resolve of the world to continue to impose sanctions on Russia and take other measures that are necessary. Now, it's conceivable that it could have an effect on Putin internally within Russia. One example that scholars sometimes use is the indictment of Slobodan Milosevic, who committed atrocities in the Balkans. He was the Serb leader who was indicted by a precursor to the International Criminal Court. That was the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. And some scholars say that, so he was indicted for atrocities. And some scholars say that that indictment undermined his support within Serbia. So it's at least conceivable.
Right. I mean, that is, if the people within Russia get the accurate news that this is
right. I mean, there's misinformation rampant. Russia has, you know, made it a crime to even say the word war in Russia. So journalists cannot operate. Protesters are being thrown in jail. It's, you know, it's an authoritarian country. So, yes, it's very hard for information to get to Russia.
Well, speaking of atrocities, Russia invaded Chechnya and that Grozny was just laid to waste. Was there any kind of accountability there? That was in the 1990s.
Right. I mean, and I would also point to atrocities committed by Russia and Russian-backed authorities in Georgia and also in Syria. One thing I would say about the later atrocities, so Georgia in particular, and now Syria. In Georgia, the International Criminal Court has opened an investigation there, and that has been ongoing. Just a few days ago, the International Criminal Court prosecutor, Karim Khan, announced a request for arrest warrants of three Russian-backed Ossetian authorities there for war crimes they committed. And he also noted that a now deceased Russian general was implicated in those war crimes. It was interesting too, when he issued the statement, he said, My office has made findings of similar patterns of conduct during its preliminary examination of the situation in Ukraine. I remain profoundly concerned about ongoing allegations of international crimes occurring amidst active hostilities in Ukraine today. So I read that as an observer. I read that as a strong message to Russia that the International Criminal Court is not going to be afraid to investigate the crimes in Ukraine and issue indictments if necessary.
And they would indict Vladimir Putin?
Well, I don't know about that. Obviously, it would depend on the evidence. But, it's possible they could indict individuals if there's evidence, for example, of generals deliberately targeting civilians or using indiscriminate weapons, for example. Again, it will depend on where the evidence leads. I should note that for anyone who is indicted and if there is an arrest warrant requested, that can have a significant impact on the individual's ability to travel if other countries have been asked to enforce those warrants.
Right, and hand them over to the criminal court. Laura Dickinson, professor of law at the George Washington University School of Law, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, how abortion rights are under threat in red states. We'll discuss the latest court and legislative moves in Texas and in Missouri with Jessica Levinson, our legal, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's pretty much the end of the line for abortion rights advocates in Texas who brought a federal challenge to block the state's restrictive law. That law effectively bans abortions as early as 6 weeks before many women even know they're pregnant, and private citizens are empowered to enforce that law. On Friday, the Texas Supreme Court ended a lawsuit seeking to overturn the law, and nearby red states are trying to pass similar legislation now. In Missouri, lawmakers introduced bills that would prevent women from leaving the state to get an abortion, and it makes it illegal to terminate an ectopic pregnancy. Press Play's regular legal eagle, Jessica Levinson, is here now. She teaches law at Loyola Law School. Hello.
Happy Daylight Saving Day. A lot to talk about.
Thank you. A lot to talk about. There have been several court challenges to this law. What happened on Friday and how did we get here?
How did we get here? Maybe the greatest question. So as your listeners know, Texas passed this very restrictive abortion law. And what makes it important is not just that it bans all abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, it's that it's enforced by private individuals. So normally the state passes a law, the state enforces that law. In this case, the state passes a law and it says private individuals, sometimes described as bounty hunters or vigilantes, you enforce the law. So when the law was first challenged, there was a question as to, can anyone even be sued to stop this law? And that's really what happened this week as well. So the Supreme Court first looked at this and said, oh, this is just so complicated. We don't know, even though our current abortion standards clearly would say that Texas's law is not constitutional. We're just going to let it go into effect because these procedural questions about who can be sued are just so tough. The case goes up again to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court says, okay, you can sue medical board professionals. There can be a suit in federal court. It can be against some people who work for the state. It's these medical licensing board professionals. Then the case is supposed to go back down to the trial court. Abortion providers are supposed to then have their time in court, their trial. Instead, the Fifth Circuit, which is the intermediate court, kind of does this weird, you know what, actually, we think we're going to send this question to the Texas Supreme Court of who can be sued to stop this law. The U.S. Supreme Court says, okay. And on Friday, the Texas Supreme Court says, yeah, you can't sue these medical board professionals. And that's why, Madeline, you totally accurately explained that this is the end of the line for the suit.
Okay. Why did they say they couldn't sue these medical licensing board professionals?
Because of how the law is structured, because they said they're not enough, basically, of state actors. They're not the ones actually enforcing the law. And so this is going to bring up, as you and I have talked about, a much bigger issue, not just about abortion, as if that wasn't important enough, but about whether or not blue states, red states can set up these laws where private individuals are the ones to sue to enforce them. And then whether that means a federal court can never stop those laws, even if they're unconstitutional. That's why Governor Newsom is proposing this new gun restriction law, because he's saying, okay, Supreme Court, I'll see you and I'll raise you.
Right. And so in terms of it being the end of the line in Texas, before we get to some of these other states, which are now trying to put in copycat laws, what does this mean for women in Texas? Do they have no other option when it comes to challenging this law? Is this really it functionally?
So that's a great question. It means that the best hope of trying to stop the law statewide, which I will say without getting into too much of the weeds, there was still a question as to whether this suit could even stop the law from being enforced statewide. Yes, it's the end of the line for now. I'll get back to for now in 1 second. The suits that remain are really piecemeal. It's, can you enforce the law with respect to this particular person? It doesn't offer the chance to wholesale stop a law that is, again, still under current law, under Roe v. Wade, unconstitutional. The reason I said for now is if at the end of June, as we all expect, the Supreme Court wipes Roe v. Wade off of the case books and says there is no longer a constitutionally protected right to have an abortion, at that point, I think the other challenges to Texas's law may fade as well.
Okay, well, let's get into how this is energizing other like-minded states. And there is a move in Missouri to not try to prevent women from getting abortions outside the state. Tell us about that.
This is actually fairly extraordinary when it just comes to our understanding of state power. So as you said, a lot of states are implementing these copycat laws just in terms of trying to create private rights of enforcement. But what Missouri saw is that when it comes to what's happening in Texas and what typically happens when you pass these really restrictive abortion laws is that women who do have means are traveling to other states. So I think Planned Parenthood said they saw an 800% increase in abortion patients traveling to neighboring states outside of Texas. Missouri sees this, they don't like it, and they say, we're going to propose a law where you can't help a resident of Missouri obtain an abortion out of state. Again, that's really breathtaking in the sense that we understand state sovereignty to mean states control what happens in their boundaries, but not extraterritorial, not outside of their boundaries.
Mm-hmm. So what would that mean? Would that mean that the woman herself would be banned from traveling, or would it mean that the gas station attendant who helped her fill up her tank of gas could be prosecuted? What does that actually mean?
It basically means anybody who assists. So just like the Texas law, it doesn't specifically challenge the woman who obtains the abortion. It's everybody who facilitates and or allows or helps that to happen. So maybe you call to make an appointment. Maybe you lent your car. Maybe your gas is a good example because it feels like it's stretched. But under the language of the proposed law, I'm not sure that you couldn't have somebody go after the gas station attendant in that case. So it upends our understanding of state sovereignty, but that is how far it could potentially stretch.
And potentially they could go after a medical provider in another state? Is that also within this proposal?
So I think so. Again, I think that this proposal under current constitutional doctrine, and we all know that can change, it's really to say that it's questionable is to use a euphemism, but yes, it could go also after medical providers, again, because that would be, under my understanding, somebody who assists a Missouri resident in obtaining mm-hmm. an out-of-state abortion.
And also, they are proposing banning abortions for ectopic pregnancies. That also would seem to be unconstitutional.
Right. And I think that that is correct, again, under current case law. And I hate to right. keep saying that, but I think our understanding of what is protected under the federal constitution will change dramatically at the end of June. These, of course, are pregnancies where you cannot carry a fetus to term, and they account for a significant, my understanding is, percentage of women who have bad outcomes, bad medical outcomes as a result of pregnancies.
Right. Okay. So you're saying that after the Supreme Court rules on the Mississippi case and is likely to side with Mississippi, that all of these laws could then be looked in a different light?
Exactly. So Mississippi is, as we know, it's a 15-week ban on abortion, and that is not currently constitutional. But the court decided to take the case. I think you and I talked the day of oral arguments, and I mm-hmm. said, based on the questioning, it is not looking like there are at least five members of the court to say we respect Roe, which means that under the federal constitution, women would no longer have a protected right, constitutionally protected right, to obtain an abortion. That then kicks it to the states to determine whether or not they want to allow abortions, or, depending on how the Supreme Court rules, completely outlaw abortions. And then we have the next step question, which is the one Missouri is bringing up. Well, what about states that try and reach into neighboring states?
Jessica Levinson teaches law at Loyola Law School. She's our regular legal here on Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a new idea for getting people off the streets.
If this was my sister, if this was my brother, or if this was my kid, I would do anything to make sure that they're not living on the street barefoot in their poop and pee.
A statewide plan to force people into treatment. We'll talk about the governor's idea next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We'll drive under any highway overpass here in Los Angeles, and you're likely to find people living there. Many of them are struggling with severe mental illness and drug addiction, which is why Governor Gavin Newsom is trying to sell lawmakers on a big plan he says could help these people. His idea is to give judges more power to force people struggling with addiction and severe mental illness into court-ordered care. So far, details on his so-called care courts are still scant. But one thing is for sure, they would require a massive expansion of the state's social services network, potentially forcing thousands of Californians into as much as 2 years of treatment, involuntary treatment. We're going to talk about that now with two people. Alex Barnard is an assistant professor of sociology at New York University. He's writing a book on involuntary mental health treatment in California. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Great to have you. Also joining us is Dr. Susan Partovi. She's a medical director for Homeless Healthcare Los Angeles, a nonprofit that offers mental health services, needle exchanges, and other services to people living on the streets. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Well, let's begin with you, Susan. What are you seeing with your patients? How many of the people you treat are experiencing severe mental health problems, and how much of it could be drug-related?
It depends on where you go. So for example, if you're in Skid Row or the downtown area, there are lots of people who are displaying psychotic behaviors. And the reason why I say it like that is we don't know what the reason is. What we have been seeing is a lot of meth use. And if you have read The Least of Us by Sam Quinones.
Mm-hmm. He's been on this show.
Yeah. So he's described this recent trend with meth that actually causes psychotic behaviors. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing a lot of older people starting to have symptoms of what looks like schizophrenia. So there's definitely pockets of areas in LA County where there's a lot of severely mentally ill, and it's pretty obvious.
Is that different from a few years ago in your personal experience?
Absolutely. Almost everyone that I almost everyone, not everyone, but almost everyone I encounter on the street is using meth.
Alex, you wrote on Twitter that you think this proposal is interesting because it could force the mental health care system to do better by people with really complicated needs, and that this could create some accountability for the providers. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. So it's not actually clear what this bill would do in terms of making it easier to force people into treatment. There are already mechanisms of that. And the governor hasn't sort of clarified what happens if you don't comply with care court. I think what's more interesting here is that the court order would also apply to the mental health system, in the sense that currently we have a system where, on one hand, you could be subject to kind of tends to be short-term involuntary treatment, or you're offered voluntary services, and if you say no sort of three times as a result of rules around reimbursements and things like that, they're going to close your file. And what I think, if care courts are going to do something positive, it's going to be sort of filling in this middle ground of making sure that people are receiving really persistent offers of services that's there to sort of catch them if there's a moment where they're more open to services, or, if they are dealing with substance abuse issues, they had a, really bad day, and so they're thinking about recovery. And I think that's one piece of the care court proposal that is promising.
Disability Rights California has come out against this idea. And I guess they're worried that it will sweep up all sorts of people and put them into places that are inhumane, or that they don't want to be in. And it's a violation of their individual rights. What is your reaction to that?
Well, I think that's a really important and valid concern. But again, it's not clear how this proposal would actually increase the number of people placed in long-term institutions. And the governor has not been clear about what the kind of coercive mechanism behind this care court's proposal is. Again, there's already laws in California that allow for people to be placed under short-term involuntary treatment or conservatorship, which could be long-term involuntary treatment. And there are proposals to expand that, but that's not part of the care court's proposal. We don't really know what the enforcement mechanism here is yet.
Right. So you've got the 5150 hold, right? That's a 72-hour hold for people who are exhibiting symptoms of psychiatric distress. There's also Laura's Law. Susan, how, as far as you can understand it, how different would this proposal be?
That's a good question. That's one that we're asking, like, how is this going to be different than Laura's Law? We're not advocating for more institutionalization. In fact, anything that looks like an institution is really not what we're advocating for. We're advocating for what we call housing that heals, and that can be for any spectrum of where someone is at in their mental illness. And so we're hoping to develop that culture in California, mm-hmm. and really push for that.
Yeah. So I guess the next question, the next obvious question is, does that exist, Alex? Do these kinds of more humane treatment places exist in California to the extent that we would presumably need them?
There's no shortage of models out there. And I think the question is about scaling them. There's programs like Synergy in Morgan Hill and South Bay that are really known for having a combination of cutting edge mental health treatment, but also, really positive living conditions and sort of a variety of supports. One thing I would say to these really important civil liberties critiques of care courts is that we're not currently living in a civil libertarian paradise here in California. California actually has really high rates of short-term involuntary treatment. So the status quo is not one that's really protecting people's civil liberties. And so I think trying to come up with a mechanism by which people are connecting to longer term treatment rather than, just cycling through really short-term, 5150 holds, for example. If care courts was able to do that, that actually would probably be a, a positive for civil liberties rather than a restriction of them.
Not to mention the inhumanity of letting people suffer on the streets, living on the streets.
I think that is what creates this momentum to do something, to come up with something new. I think, you know, care courts is an interesting idea. It's not one that has been tested, so there's not a strong evidence base behind it. So it is really important that there's also a strong evaluation component. And I haven't heard about that yet in these proposals. But, you know, we need to know if this works. We need to know whether it works. And we need to know what works, because it might just be that offering people better, you know, persistent services is what works. And you don't need to have a judge involved. We might find out the judge is really important. But right now, you know, we have questions about that. But we don't have data.
And Susan, how hard is it to treat people who are suffering from this drug addiction to this very potent form of meth that causes people to exhibit signs of schizophrenia?
It takes a lot of work. And what we've been able to do, and the most important part, is building trust and building a relationship with your client, say that you're seeing on the street or in the clinic. And what's really become a lifesaver is these long-acting injectables that are antipsychotics. And we're not forcing people. We're building a relationship with them. And during their times of lucidity, they understand sometimes that this might help them with their, and we use layman's terms, like with their disorganized thoughts or their insomnia or their anxiety or their voices. So once that gets stabilized, then we've been able to get people into interim housing really quickly. And so it's hard because it takes the time and you have to build that relationship. But then once they accept the medication voluntarily, they do really well. The way I like to look at it is like, if this was my sister, if this was my brother, or if this was my kid, you know, I'm 54 years old. I can, you know, the 20 something year olds, 30 year olds, they can be my kid. I would do anything to make sure that they're not living on the street barefoot in their poop and pee. You know what I mean? So that's where I'm coming from. I'm not coming from, and, you know, Alex, too, he's gone out with me. We're not coming from let's sweep everybody up and, you know, get them out of our streets, you know, because they're an eyesore. It's more like we've met these people. We've developed a relationship with them. And every time we see them, it breaks our hearts. Mm-hmm. But
there is that sentiment. Yeah, definitely, because you're service providers, but. Or you are, Alex, you're studying this. But there are people, regular people, politicians, people running for office, who are saying, sweep them up and get them off the streets, because it's just too much. There's crime associated with these encampments. There's just the general disorder. There's the, I don't know, just a general level of frustration that these encampments have been allowed to flourish. And it seems like very little is being done for people living there. So I think there is that frustration and desire to just sweep it out of, you know, out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah, there's no sweeping involved. So even if someone just mentions the word sweep them out, you know, it really takes a lot of work, a lot of organization, a lot of interactions, a lot of legwork to find places for people. And we're not talking about shelters. People don't want to stay in a shelter. There's a lot of issues with shelters, and people have had bad experiences, and especially those with mental illness or drug use. They don't appreciate you know, the rules or the lack of privacy. And so, you know, finding the interim housing or the temporary housing that fits the needs of each person takes a lot of work.
Alex, as we've discussed, there are several laws already on the books that can be employed to get someone into care, at least temporarily. What needs to be in this legislation that is not in these other pieces of legislation?
Well, I think the reality is we have these laws about forcing people into treatment, but you know, professionals thankfully aren't going to use these laws if there's nowhere for people to go. So, you know, the real question we need to answer in California is how many, you know, sort of placements, facilities, beds we want to construct, and at what level of care. So there's been analyses that suggest, you know, actually we don't necessarily need more hospital beds if we had appropriate, you know, step down placements, longer term housing, residential treatment. So I think that's the real question. I think you can tinker with the law all you want. You can redefine certain criteria, and that might be helpful for some individuals. And I think Dr. Partovi has done really important work around that. But at the end of the day, you know, the real decision is going to be sort of what kind of infrastructure California is going to build. And I think that's a really big question, right? Do you expand voluntary services that are in the community? Do you expand residential treatment? Do you sort of do all of the above strategy where you try and build across a whole continuum? I think there is a lot of money coming from the governor for sure, but I don't know if there's been the level of reflection about where the greatest need is, and whether that has to be at that kind of most restrictive, you know, locked hospital bed kind of level of care.
Well, thank you both so much for coming on the show today to talk about this.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Oh, our pleasure.
That's Alex Barnard. He teaches sociology at New York University, and he's writing a book on involuntary mental health treatment in California. Dr. Susan Partovi is the medical director for Homeless Healthcare Los Angeles. Coming up, the Oscars are right around the corner. Why the Academy often overlooks the best movie songs of the year. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
It feels so good to be alive. Got all my family by my side.
That's Be Alive by Beyoncé from the film King Richard. She's nominated for Best Original Song at this year's Oscars. She has some stiff competition. Beyoncé is up against Billie Eilish, Lin-Manuel Miranda, Van Morrison, and a 13-time Best Original Song nominee who's hoping this will finally be the year she takes home the Oscar. Joining us to talk about all this is film critic Noah Gittel. Welcome to Press Play.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So it sounds like the Grammys almost. Is this typical to have all these stars nominated?
It is typical. I mean, the best original song category is very, it's a mixed bag year to year. But typically, filmmakers get big stars like Lin-Manuel Miranda or Beyoncé or Billie Eilish to record songs for their films as part of the promotional package. You know, these songs are often released as singles, and that helps drive attention to the films. But I also think part of the planning is to get these songs nominated for Oscars so that the film will be noticed by the awards bodies. The performers will be invited to come sing at the Oscars. Hmm. And again, it just draws more attention to the film. So it's a small but very important part of the overall process.
Well, let's play the song that Lin-Manuel Miranda is nominated for. It's from the film Encanto. The song is called Dos Oruguitas, which translates to Two Caterpillars. And here's a bit from that. Hacia adelante seguirás, vienen milagros, vienen crisálidas. Hay que partir y construir su propio futuro. Hay oruguitas, no se aguante más. Hay que crecer, aparte y volver. Hacia adelante seguirás, vienen milagros, vienen crisálidas. Hay que partir.
What I can tell you about this song that is unusual is that this is not the song anybody expected would be nominated from the Encanto soundtrack. The clear hit from this soundtrack was We Don't Talk About Bruno, which was a number one hit that emerged from this soundtrack and really captured the zeitgeist. We don't talk about Bruno.
next day. Dead.
No, no.
He told me I'd grow a glass, and just like he said that all my hair would disappear. Now look at my hair.
Your fate is sealed when your prophecy is read.
He told me that the life of my dreams would be promised and someday be mine.
Now, that wasn't actually released as a single. It just kind of became a hit. It really just resonated with the public. So it wasn't submitted as one of the songs from the film. And I think it'll be sort of a proxy vote for We Don't Talk About Bruno, which I think most people would agree is the best song from the soundtrack.
So also, this could get Lin-Manuel Miranda an EGOT, right? Because he's already got an Emmy. He's already got a Grammy. He's already got a Tony. So do voters think that way?
I think they do. I think they love Lin-Manuel Miranda. And I think you can see that. I mean, first of all, there's been this movie musical renaissance this year. There were 5-6 major movie musicals that came out. And a lot of that has to do with Hamilton and how Lin-Manuel Miranda with that show really got young people excited about the musical again. But also, he directed Tick, Tick, Boom, which is an Oscar movie. It got nominations for Best Actor, for Best Editing. So it's very clear that the Academy likes Lin-Manuel Miranda, is thinking about Lin-Manuel Miranda. And he would be, I believe, only the 17th person to complete the EGOT. And you have to think that these folks who know him very well and appreciate his contributions to Hollywood would love to make that a kind of big Oscar moment.
All right, next up we have the latest James Bond film and song, No Time to Die, music and lyrics by Billie Eilish and her brother Phineas.
Fool me once, fool me twice, are you dead or paradise? Now you'll never see me cry. There's just more time to die. More time to die.
All right, Noah, it seems like every James Bond film is nominated for Best Song.
That's right. And a lot of them end up winning. Adele famously won for Skyfall 6 or 7 years ago. And I think No Time to Die also has a very good chance. It probably comes down to Billie Eilish or Lin-Manuel Miranda for this Oscar. It's just a really good song. It really sets the tone for the movie. Billie Eilish has a very strong vocal performance here. And she's as big a star as anyone in this category that has a lot of big stars. And I think there's something nice about the tradition, as you said, of honoring the theme songs for James Bond movies. You know, Hollywood does care about tradition, and the Oscars do care about tradition, even though they're not really being given credit for that right now with some of the changes that they're making. But this is a nice way to kind of honor history while honoring an artist who is very much of the moment as well.
Well, speaking about history, let's talk about Diane Warren. She's nominated a lot. I think she's been called the Susan Lucci of Oscar songs. She's also nominated this time around. This is her 13th Oscar nomination. It is for a song called Somehow You Do from the movie Four Good Days. And here is a clip of it performed by country star Reba McEntire.
You wanna give up the fight? You see no relief inside, and it's hard to keep the love of faith. But the darkest night still finds a day. When you think it's the end of the road, it's just 'cause you don't know where the road's leading to. When you think that the mountain's too high and the ocean's too wide, you'll never get through.
So this is Diane Warren's 13th Oscar nomination, and I'm assuming she is not the favorite to win this time around either.
Correct. And I don't know whether to feel bad for Diane Warren or to feel happy for her, because she has had 13 nominations and it's her fifth in 5 years. So her name is almost always heard on Oscar night, which is certainly, as they say, an honor in and of itself. But this is not expected to win for a couple reasons. I don't think the song particularly pops. Like, it's not going to wow anybody when compared to a couple of the other songs on this list. But also, it's from a film called Four Good Days that, frankly, not very many people have seen. I mean, I'm a film critic, and I don't know anyone who has seen this movie. And
that's I don't think I've heard of it, to be honest.
It's a drug addiction drama with Glenn Close and Mila Kunis. It's got some talented people in it. But it didn't get much of a release. And frankly, it feels like the only reason it was made was in the hopes of getting a Best Original Song nomination, because there really was nothing else remarkable about it. But maybe some people will see it, people who are Oscar completists. Although frankly, it's very possible the people who nominated this song didn't even see it, because they are not required to watch the movies. They get 3-minute clips of all the eligible songs and they base their voting entirely on that.
All right, well, let's talk about Van Morrison, and he is nominated for his song Down to Joy. This is from a film called Belfast, which is nominated for Best Picture. Let's take a listen.
Well, the sleepless night, I had a kind of dream for sure. When I woke up in the morning, felt like I was coming down to joy. What did I see? What did I hear? When I was coming down, had a brand new story. But I was coming down to joy. Felt so good, gratitude. When I was coming down.
So it's a good song, and Van Morrison is obviously an icon, but there's two factors going against it. One is just the strength of the competition. And there's a couple other songs here that we've mentioned that are really appealing to Academy members. And Van Morrison is not appealing to Academy members because he is a very vocal anti-vaxxer. And, you know, the Academy created a rule this year that audience members need to be vaccinated, have a COVID vaccination to attend, but performers and presenters don't. And it has been speculated that that was done mostly to lure Van Morrison to perform. And the Academy Board may be excited about that, but I don't think voters will be excited about that. I think his attitude probably flies in the face of a lot of what the more liberal members of the Academy believe. So I don't think he has a shot at this particular time. Van Morrison's chances to win an Oscar have probably said bye.
Yeah. I'm not sure there's a groundswell of people dying to see Van Morrison perform anyway at the Oscars. I don't know where the Academy.
That's probably true, but the Academy Board does like to get as many stars as possible. And he probably appeals to a certain demographic.
Right. All right, let's talk about the snubs. Which songs should have been nominated that were not nominated?
Well, there's a couple worth mentioning. You know, there's this musical that came out called Cyrano. Mm-hmm. Which it's based on Cyrano de Bergerac. It stars Peter Dinklage, and it has songs written by The National, which is a terrific band. It is based on a play, so most of the songs in it are actually not eligible because they have to be written expressly for the movie. But there were two songs that were written for the movie that were quite good, and I was a little surprised to see neither of them be nominated. To me, the biggest snub is a song called So May We Start, which is the opening song in the avant-garde French musical Annette, starring Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard. Now, when I say avant-garde French musical, I mean, that might explain what's not quite aligned with the Academy's taste. Yeah. But in a very strange film that was very divisive, everyone really agrees that this opening scene, which is a fourth wall breaking kind of scene in which the actors appear as themselves and the band Sparks, who also had a bit of a moment this year. There was a documentary made about them. They appear as themselves. And it's really a wonderful moment that kicks off the film with such energy and enthusiasm. And I'm not surprised the film wasn't honored in a lot of other ways, but I think when we look back at this year, I think it will look like a surprise and a mistake that song wasn't recognized, at least with a nomination.
Well, here's a little tidbit for you. We have a show called Bookworm on KCRW, and Sparks did the theme song.
Well, there you go.
We so every week you can hear the Sparks on the radio.
And I will say, you know, this is a category in which the snubs often have much more of a lasting impact than the songs that are actually awarded and nominated. You know, Call Me, a Blondie song, was written for American Gigolo, was not nominated. New York, wow. New York, the iconic song, was written for Martin Scorsese's film New York, New York, and that was not nominated. Nothing from Spinal Tap was nominated. So there's a long history here of the Academy getting it wrong. And I don't know if I would go so far as to say not nominating So May We Start is that egregious of an error, but it certainly seems like it should have been recognized to me.
All right, so let's hear it now. So May We Start from Sparks, and better luck next year, I guess, Sparks. Noah Gittell, he is film critic and lecturer on the Oscars for the Smithsonian's educational program, Smithsonian Associates. Noah, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you. They hope that it
goes the way. And that's it for us here on Press Play. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow. Can't let it show. They're under prepared.